Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Saturday, December the 18th. We are 1 week away from Christmas Day, actually a couple of weeks from 2022. So if it's Christmas, who else but our good friend Frank Burke up in beautiful Wisconsin. We got a lot to get into today with Frank, so let me put him on, wish him a Merry Christmas, Frank, and as I always do, give us a weather report from Wisconsin.
Well, a very merry and blessed Christmas to you and all our listeners. In Wisconsin today, at least in our part of Wisconsin, I would say it's in the 20s. The other night we were in that tremendous, I don't know what you'd call it, weather system, mm-hmm. where all night long we had tremendous winds, some up to 70 miles an hour.
Wow.
But fortunately, nobody here was hurt. I think there was one tornado spotted in the state, but that didn't do, at least not to my knowledge, did any damage, and certainly no one was hurt. But
yeah.
So thank God for that. But, yeah, the weather has been not bad for Wisconsin. There's green grass outside and just a little tiny bit of snow here and there. We were supposed to have some flurries today. But the snow is late this year, which is not a big problem.
Yes. Well, we may get flurries ourselves tomorrow. They're not forecasting it, but it's 36. It's going to be 36 tomorrow morning.
Wow.
So, you know, that's not unusual for Dallas. A lot of people don't realize that we do have a winter in North Texas. I mean, we do have one. It's just not Wisconsin. So, I mean, but, yeah,
right,
it's supposed to be 36 Sunday morning, 34. Monday morning, 37. Tuesday morning, 34. 39. So it's going to be like in the mid-30s for the next five or six days as we wake up. So, you know, again, it's not Wisconsin, but you don't go outside in sandals and shorts.
No, and let's put it this way. It's a nice change for Christmas. It's that Christmassy feeling. It may or may not be a white Christmas, but then again, it may or may not be for us either.
Right. No, but you're right. I think the change of temperature actually is a nice thing to have. You know, on this day in history, Frank, that we're doing our show, 1620, the Mayflower actually got to what we now call Plymouth Rock. And I think it's somewhat interesting because, you know, the reason we're celebrating Christmas 401 years later is because of those people who showed up at the Plymouth Rock. So, I mean, it kind of started there, although obviously they were not the first Europeans to get here. I mean, by 1620, a lot of Latin America had already been discovered, and the Spanish were way into their colonization. But at least in North America, it got started around this time, Frank.
It did, and it's amazing because, you know, the Puritans, let me put it this way, they were a dour lot. We talk a lot about them, and they're kind of glorified, but really you wouldn't have wanted to be there. You wouldn't have wanted to be a Puritan. They would not have celebrated Christmas. It would have been, yes, it's Christmas, it's the day of the Nativity, and now let's go chop some wood or something like that. You know, they didn't celebrate it the way we think about it. They were not very joyous.
Many of them were freezing to death.
Yes.
Literally. I mean, this was not, I mean, I guess we just don't realize how, you know, I guess you just don't realize how difficult life was back then. I mean, we talked about, you know, 37 degrees. Yeah, but I'm inside.
Yeah.
And it's going to be 34 tomorrow morning, but I'm not going to be outside all night, you know, in a house without heater. So I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes we don't really, I guess, realize how lucky we are, I guess, in a way.
That's true.
To have the kind of life we have right now, we complain about this or this or that. But certainly when it comes to Mother Nature, I'd rather live in 2021 than 1620. I'll put it to you that way.
I would agree with you there. Of course, you know, there have been some tough Christmases in our history. The Christmas at 1777 in Valley Forge was a tremendously cold and a lot of privation. And those people really suffered to give us our freedom. In World War II, you know, Bastogne and all of these terrible weather systems that occurred when we were trying to get something worthwhile done. Let's put it that way, whether it's fight for freedom, fight Nazism, or establish the Plymouth Colony.
That's right. No, and a couple of things that come to mind around Christmas time. The loss of Glenn Miller in 1944. He was on his way to Paris to do a Christmas concert, and his plane was lost. It's still missing in action. That's the amazing thing. Nobody has officially closed that case. It's still an open case. The other Christmas story is in 1914, and I think maybe this is the one you were talking about. 1914, on Christmas Day, I guess they did a one-day ceasefire, and German and British troops actually stopped killing each other and decided to play a little soccer there on the battlefield.
Yeah, and they really enjoyed each other, yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting, because you play soccer with somebody at 5 o'clock on Christmas Day, and then the next day you got out and kill them. I don't know. That must be strange.
I would think it's very strange. Exactly.
Yeah. But and then the other big thing that happened around Christmas time, Frank, was the Battle of the Bulge, which actually began, I think, around this time in 1944. So there have been some interesting things around the calendar at this time of the year. Now, of course, what we're going through now, and we'll talk a little bit about this, is that for the second consecutive year, we're dealing with a pandemic. Now, I actually think it was more complicated last year when we did our show last year. There was a lot more about this. But this year, you know, I don't think it's complicated, but it's starting to get complicated. And we've got this debate about mandates, Frank. And now, you know, one court said it's, you know, you cannot mandate it. Another court said you can. And it's become kind of like judges playing volleyball, you know, yes, you can, no, you can't. And to me, whatever you think of mandates, and I like to hear your thoughts, Frank, but whatever, what we're really seeing here, I think, is a failure of presidential leadership. Because instead of writing an executive order to do this, what he should have done is gone to Congress and say, let's pass a law that takes into consideration everything. But he didn't. He wrote an executive order. So when you write executive orders, Frank, this is what happens. You end up in the courts, Frank.
Well, there's no provision in the Constitution for mandates. Let's put it this way. And the idea that a president can issue mandates on any subject when he wants for any reason certainly leads to a dictatorship. It is a dictatorship. That's the very definition of it. It's like China, you know. Nobody's going to argue with Xi if he's sends out another mandate, or North Korea. But that's not our way. It's not our system of government. And not only that, but what it's done is to totally politicize what is a health crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And look at in this past few years, just in his and what they've found out, it really goes back to the Trump administration because of what was not because of Trump or his people, but because of what was going on then. Think about this. As a result of what's happened in the last few years, most Americans, myself included, have lost all confidence in the integrity of the FBI,
mm-hmm.
the Centers for Disease Control, and the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, and you can go right down the list because
right.
it's been proven that these people have been acting from political motives and that they have been acting without due authority from anything and
mm-hmm.
And literally just creating a situation where there you have some power-hungry people like Dr. Fauci who
mm-hmm.
will not go away, despite the fact that they keep stumbling over themselves and contradicting themselves.
Right, that's right, that's right. And I mean, I agree with you completely that there is no constitutional authority for the president to do something like this. If anything, it should be left to the states or the voters or the states, I mean, not the president.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're going to do it at all, it should be done by the states. But there is, I mean, at times in history, and again, going back to another Christmas, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor, and
yes.
that Christmas, of course, that was tainted by Pearl Harbor. At that time, or in that presidency, not necessarily that Christmas, you had a president who used executive orders to let's say take Japanese Americans and put them in these ranches or whatever where they were separated from
mm-hmm.
from the population. I know people like to say concentration camps. They were not concentration camps. That is going
no.
way too far, I think. I mean, they were isolated. Their freedom was taken away. I accept that. But they were not mistreated
right.
by in any way, shape, or fashion. But what my point is that was done by an executive order of the president,
mm-hmm.
but he did it as commander-in-chief with a war declaration. And when you're the president
exactly.
of the United States and you have a war declaration, you can do a few things. As commander-in-chief, as we saw with President Bush in Guantanamo or in some of the things that he did to listen to terrorist conversations and that kind of thing. But there you have the Congress has agreed to a war. They've given you the authority to win the war, so you can do a couple more things and get away with it. But right now
mm-hmm.
we don't have such a thing. I mean, we have a virus. And I'm not undermining the virus one bit. It's a serious thing, and I've known people who've been very hard hit by it, and one who died. But, you know, I don't think this administration has handled it correctly. I think what they should have done is maybe go to the Congress, maybe do the equivalent of a war declaration on the virus or something.
Yes.
But at least you have the constitutional authority to act. He doesn't right now. And
no.
this is going to end up in the Supreme Court, and God only knows what happens then, Frank.
Well, of course. And, you know, now his cohort, like Elizabeth Warren, are talking about trying to pack the Supreme Court. And they're trying to talk about federalizing voting regulations so that regardless of what happens in an election, in a fair election, they can win the election.
Yes. Reminds me, Frank, whenever I hear about federalizing the elections, okay, in other words, having one computer that counts all the votes, it reminds
yeah.
me of a very good story that I hope Americans, most Americans don't know this story because they're not familiar with Mexico like I am. But on election day 1988 in Mexico, remember, in Mexico, they have one computer that counts all the votes, which is what these people want. They want everything channeled through the central government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in Mexico, on election night 1988, they're counting the votes, and everybody sees that there might be a surprise in the election, and that the opposition candidate might actually win. And then all of a sudden, Frank, at 10 o'clock, the computer breaks down. Literally,
uh-huh.
the computer breaks down. And everybody's saying, well, we don't have any results because the computer broke down. And I remember telling my father-in-law when that was going on, I said, you know, the good news about the United States is that we've got 50 computers, not one. So it would be very difficult for all the 50 computers to break down. But that's what worries me about federalizing elections, that all of a sudden it's in the hands of a group of people rather than the states, Frank.
Well, I'll put it this way, though, Silvio. We may have had 50 computers, but the voting machines that were used in many states, more than one state, were controlled by one company. And, you know, was there was a hacking situation. There were many more votes, millions more votes cast for Joe Biden than there are registered voters. So, you know, what happens with that?
Yes, and that, of course, I think from what I understand, and we can do a show about this some other time, but I understand they're having some issues about that in Wisconsin. I'd like to hear about
Absolutely.
That from you. Maybe we can do a show in January about that, because I know
sure.
they're having some problems up there. But you have something that you're going to read to us in the second segment. So before we get there, I wanted to for both of us to share a Christmas memory, something that takes you back maybe to your youth or whatever about Christmas. So something that when you think about Christmas reminds you of Christmas. So maybe you can share, you go first, and then I'll go, and then we'll take a break and listen to your reading, Frank.
Well, you've kind of caught me unaware with this one, Silvio. I guess I would have to say there are many. But the things that I remember, a lot of the things I remember have to do with the toys I got. And some of them I still have. And I think, you know, things are very important. They taught me a lot of lessons. But there was one toy in 1954. What I wanted was a Prince. They used to have these play sets, Prince Valiant Castle play set. There were all kinds of play sets. And a play set, many of them were made by a toy maker called Lewis Marks. And what they typically included was a beautifully lithographed tin building that had to be assembled. And it had to be bent, and then the tabs were put through slots and bent back. And, I mean, some of these things were razor sharp, and they were very hard to put together. My father always did that, of course, on Christmas Eve night. And the place that I wanted, of course, when I came down, was there, and it was absolutely beautiful. And unfortunately, it was given away by my parents at some point, but literally I bought it back. But I found another one and bought it probably 15, 20 years ago. And I've never been sorry that I did. I have to say it had gone up in price significantly. But the quick story that this reminds me of has to do with my father. Mm-hmm. And my father, of course, my parents insisted that Christmas be great for us. And they did some things that, in retrospect, were probably a little bit on the foolish side. One of them was the fact that they put up the tree on Christmas Eve. We each hung one ornament and then went to bed. And they had to decorate the whole blame tree with two people. Well, that was a custom when my mother was a kid, but she was raised by five aunts. And you had five women that could decorate the tree. And right. they didn't have these thin presents. So my father would set up my electric trains in the basement and assemble anything, and my mother's wrapping gifts and all this. So finally, it's about 4 o'clock in the morning, and they are ready to go to bed. And suddenly they discover something. They discover a tin play kitchen for my sister, which includes, and it's all this lithographed tin work that has to be bent and shaped and put together and assembled. And it includes a refrigerator and a stove and a dishwasher and everything else. And the thing is probably 3 feet long, 3.5 feet long, and a foot high. And my father stayed up and assembled it. And I'm sure he said some words about it that were not in the Christmas spirit, let me say. But the reality was that he got it all done at great personal sacrifice. I think he cut himself on a couple of the pieces of tin. God, can you imagine? They'd never let kids have those things today. But
right.
I didn't hear about that story until later, but it just brought to mind the kind of person he was and the kind of sacrifices, you know, that parents make. There are big ones, there are little ones. Perhaps you'd consider that a little one. But I guarantee you that Christmas Eve he didn't. And
right.
things parents do for their kids to make Christmas real.
Right.
And I think it was much more so in our time than at the present time, because kids just don't have that. You know, we waited for Christmas.
Right.
Because that's you didn't just get anything when you wanted it. You
mm-hmm.
asked for it. You looked forward to it. You anticipated it. And for the parents, in many cases, there were sacrifices in getting that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it meant a lot.
No, I think you're right. No, I think you're right. And in fact, it's interesting you bring up your parents, because I have the exact same memory. This is going to be the first Christmas that I will not have my parents. As you remember, my mother passed away in May, and of course my dad
yes.
passed away in 2015. And so this is going to be the first Christmas that I will not have both of them, especially my mom, who at least we had, you know, without my dad for about 5 years. And so a lot of memories about my mother are coming up to me this year. And one that makes me laugh a lot, it's a wonderful memory. When our boys were growing up and when they were still in the Santa Claus club, in other words, they still went to
right.
bed early and, you know, believed in Santa Claus, which is a beautiful thing, you know. And
of course.
Every December 24th, we would start getting phone calls from my mother at 9 o'clock. And my mother would say, put the kids on the phone, because I've got to tell them that Channel 4 is reporting that Santa Claus is on his way to Texas. they had this thing on television where they were keeping track of Santa Claus. I mean,
yes.
This is something they do every year, and it's more sophisticated
now.
NASA
does it. Believe it or
yeah,
not, it's done at the computers at NASA, yes.
Exactly. Now, it's incredibly sophisticated. I mean, now it's certainly more sophisticated than it was 20 years ago when my kids were of that age, or even, you know, my goodness, maybe even 25 years ago. But anyway, so when they were that, between 20 or 25 years ago, it was pretty sophisticated, but nothing like now. So my mother would start calling them at 9 o'clock and say, put Channel 4 on, because they're already reporting that Santa Claus is about to enter Texas. And you kids need to be asleep. And my sons would hear that, and they would look at me, and I go, yeah, I mean, look, let's put Channel 4 on. And there it was on Channel 4. They would have a map of Texas and this little, you know, Santa Claus with the reindeer coming in, you know,
from
Oklahoma or something like that. And my kids would say, well, we better get to sleep. And I said, well, you better get to sleep because, you know, Santa Claus is coming. And, you know, you don't want to be awake when he parks on the roof, you know, and drops the...
What kid could go to sleep on Christmas Eve?
Yes. So, I mean, so I'm sitting here, you know, and of course, you know, I'm caught up in the whole thing myself, because even though I knew that my mom was obviously, I mean, I knew that Santa Claus was not... You know, I'm an adult now. I'm not supposed to believe in Santa Claus. But you get to a point where you look at this thing on the TV and you say, man, he's coming. We better get...
Yeah,
you have
exactly.
You have to get in the mental state when you're trying to persuade a five-year-old that he better get to bed because Santa Claus is coming. So we would get him to bed. Now, this is maybe 9:45, 10 o'clock. And they're in bed. They fell asleep pretty quickly because they had that motivation of getting up and seeing the gifts. So now we've got like from 10 o'clock at night until maybe 1 o'clock in the morning while we're putting out the gifts. So I'm sitting there, you know, because I wanted to make sure they were fully asleep, you know, before we put the gifts out. So we turn off all the lights. So here I am in our room with my little shortwave radio listening to Radio Spain. They're doing, because of the time difference, now it's like 6 or 7 o'clock in Spain. So I'm the next day, right? So I'm listening to radio,
right.
You know, international, like the BBC of Spain, and I'm listening
sure.
to that, and they're doing reports. But now they're reporting about kids waking up and actually opening up the gifts. So this whole memory comes to mind because of my mother, because my mother was the one who made that phone call and told my kids, hey, look at Channel 4, Santa Claus.
Right, so he's on his way.
he's on his way. And there he was on Channel 4. You could see it on the map, like the weather map, you know, like when they show you the storms coming. You could actually see Santa Claus. So that's the, you know, the memory. I have so many memories, but that's the one, I guess, that sticks out this year, because my mother is not going to be with us this year. And I don't know. This is just a memory that I have of her on Christmas Day. And it really the memory is very vivid right now in my mind, because she's not going to be here.
In her memory, when you're – grandchildren are of an age, you have to make that call.
Absolutely.
And tell them what channel to turn on.
That's right. They'll probably have iPhones by you know, they're going to say, what's a TV, you know? Where's my iPhone?
Right,
where's
exactly.
my tablet? But you're right. The idea is the same. The idea is the same, that, hey, kids, get to bed. Because Santa is on his way. So when I, you know, it's funny that you brought up your parents, because I, you know, completely independent, because I didn't know you were going to bring that up. And so, but my memory is exactly along the same lines of a parent, in this case, my mother, and the memory of 9 o'clock. I never forget the 24th at 9 o'clock, the phone would ring. And, you know, we look at each other, and we kind of knew who the call was. We didn't need caller ID to know who was calling. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun, Frank.
Well, you know, I'll just put it all together with this. And that's the fact that I know what your parents went through with having to leave Cuba and all that, and leave a good life, what had been a good life. And I know that my parents, who were older, when I was born, when my sister was born, went through the Great Depression. And, you know, the people who went through the Great Depression and the Second World War, I think, and who really understood what it was not to have what you wanted, not to have a lot, even if you weren't, you know, hungry, if you made it through that, they were very determined that our generation would have Christmases like maybe they wished they had had. And I think that was something that made it very important for them to make Christmas special for us.
Absolutely. No, I think you're right. I think they really, having their kids enjoy Christmas was, for them, a very important thing. And you're exactly right about that. And certainly my parents, we're always very thoughtful of that. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a little break, and then you've got a little reading that you're going to do for us, and I'm sure it's going to be great. So we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with Frank right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. You know, they say if it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press. Well, if it's Christmas, it's Frank Burke. So we're having our annual chat with Frank. Frank, I've discovered we did this in 20, in 19, in 18, in 16, in 15, and I believe in 14. There may have been one in 13, but I cannot find it. But maybe it is. But certainly, you know, we like to keep this going for a lot more years, Frank, our chat at Christmas time. And one of the reasons I want to keep it going, Frank, is because of what is about to happen. And that is when you share with us something about Christmas that you're going to read to us and you're going to share with us. So let me give you the microphone and take it away, Frank.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. You're very kind and very generous. What I'm going to read to you is actually a appeared in the Chicago Daily News in 1921 that was written by Ben Hecht. And Ben Hecht was a very famous newspaper man, generally associated with Chicago, but he and I think it was Charles, trying to think of who it was the guy who was married to Helen Hayes. They wrote the play The Front Page, which was it's been around for years in many different versions, but it's about the newspaper business and, the kind of people that then and now. Now, as I always tell my history classes when I do substitute teaching, you have to take everything in context, okay? So bear in mind, as you hear about the way he describes people, this is 1921. We have just come through World War I, which ended in 1918. And in 1920-21, there was a depression. It was not anything like the 1929 depression, and it was over rather quickly. But at the time, it was a fairly serious depression. So there was some amount of privation. But here's Ben Hecht. The piece is called Holiday Thoughts. It takes place in Chicago. I'm going to read a little bit. I'm editing some of it, but I hope you enjoy it. Okay. The observing of great holidays is a matter of tradition. There are many noble-hearted people who might experience a dawn of love for their fellow man toward the end of the year, if there had never been a Christmas. But they are in the minority. The Loop, that's the business area of Chicago, is a bit more congested than usual. I have been very busy elsewhere. Thus, walking or pushing my way down State Street, I wonder what great general is visiting the city today and where the parade was. Then I remember that it is the holiday season and that these are shoppers. Then the stores must be crowded once more. Holly wreaths are hanging from the columns. Cotton batting is doing service for snow decorations. Tinsel and glittering artifices gleam from the shelves. The shuffle of the huge store crowds is so determined, it seems as if the thing had direction and plan, as if everyone were going somewhere instead of drifting aimlessly, like myself, up and down aimless aisles. The elevator is jammed. It takes 15 minutes to get inside of the cab. We get off at the toy department. Here's a piquant chance to expand sentimentality. I vaguely remember an air of glamour resting on the scene. Vaguely familiar noises, music, shouts, vaguely familiar counters. I pause and stare for 2 long minutes at a table that I can remember. Yes. And across the aisle, toy trains. They wind up, and one that runs by electricity. Indian suits and drums. Wooden clowns. Great cardboard games in which you spin a needle and advance markers according to something. The toy department is like an almost familiar memory. It brings a faint sadness. One stands repeating to oneself, I remember. Yes, of course, I remember this and that. It seems suddenly preposterous that one was ever a child. Impossible. One says without words, it couldn't have been me. Someone else, not me. And then the things on the counters begin to gesture, hauntingly. The names of games wink intimately from gaudy cardboard boxes. The electric train whirs teasingly round and round the white tin track. Noises blur. The scene becomes a blur also, and one drifts along staring with amazed eyes at a toy clown, at a toy Noah's Ark. There is a poignancy in the moment, the poignancy of revisiting old scenes after a long absence. The old scenes contain magically a part of one's youth. Yesterdays are embalmed in them. And here, each toy is like an old scene. Each toy seems crowded with yesterdays. I look around, a crowd of people, chiefly people older than myself and a minority of children. the eyes of these people tell a haunting story. They say, look, we've grown old. We once played with toys. Now we are old and tired. And their fingers stay caressingly on pieces of tin and cardboard. Then there is the psychology of toys. Of course, children like them. They take the place of ideas and institutions in the minds of children. But men and women use them more determinedly. Men and women play with them during the furtive moments of purchase and the half-sad, half-elated consciousness of having once been children and of having once reveled in such things comes to them. Once a year, these tired, aging ones come to the confessional of the toy depremancies, coo and gurgle once more over dolls and drums. We once lived in a world of toys, in a world of adventure, in a world of strange thoughts and weird imaginings. Adventure, thoughts, and imaginings with toys like these. Yes, these toys have souls, because we remember that they meant something, were something. What is it they meant or were? But we've forgotten that. Almost. And then the crowd of women shuffle up and down the aisles, up and down the streets outside. The holidays bring them all an identical gift. The holidays bring them the gift of memory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that.
Yeah, no, I was, you know, almost like walking with you on this because you're exactly right. These gifts, these toys, you know, you look at a toy 20 years later. Now, unfortunately, most of the toys I had when I was a kid, well, unfortunately, many of them stayed in Cuba because of our situation. So, you know, a lot of stuff that I was given as a kid that I probably would have had had I not, you know, had I always lived in the same country. So a lot of these things, you know, I remember vaguely some of them because I was very young, but, I mean, there was a little train I remember that we had one time that, and, you know, that train was more than a train to us. I remember we had these little, like, buses that we would get, you know, that we would, you know, because my brother and I were fascinated with these little buses, you know, the Greyhound bus, you know, that kind of stuff, and that we would play with them. You know, these things, for me at least, and for my brother, were just were more than a piece of metal. They were actually a memory. And if I were to, you know, if I were to see one right now, it would bring back a specific memory of us, my brother and I, playing with these buses. You know, my sister had these dolls, you know. And one year I remember that her doll was getting a little, you know, beat up, you know, as not naturally happens. So my mother said that she was going to leave it out overnight. And that they were going to come over and pick it up and fix it for her. Take it to like a repair shop, I guess. And then come back. And so it was. A few days later, she got her doll all, you know, cleaned up. And so, yes, I think these gifts mean something the older you get. And I guess if I had the opportunity to get them all together and put them in a closet, every year I would open the closet because each one of these things was a memory, just like you're saying. So I that's a wonderful reading, and it really touches me.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad. It's a thing. There's a sadness there, but you know, I have always been a person who said Christmas is not for clothing. It's not for what you need. It's for what you want. So it's always been toys for me, even at this age.
Right.
This year, I'm getting a train set because if I've been good enough. I may not have been good this year, but if I've been good enough, Santa may bring me that train. And I'm a model railroader, which is entirely logical. I've never gotten out of the trains. I've had them since I was 2 years old. But the thing is, you know, one of the saddest things, years ago, when our older son was about 10 years old, he was 12, and I brought out my old Lionel trains, and I set them up in the basement all around the room for the children and for myself. I wouldn't say it was just for the kids. I love them.
Right.
And my son was looking at the first engine I ever got. And it's a metal steam engine. It was made, it's made out of metal. I still have it. And there's the engine and the tender, and it has, you know, it's a Lionel thing. It's not as detailed as some of the models they now have, but it's very, very well built, and it's very pretty to look at. And he looked at it, he was looking at it, and he looked at me and he said, you know, you guys had such great toys. We don't have anything like this.
Right.
And recently I was at a, I was making a donation of some clothing to a local charity that gives things out to families that need it, mm-hmm. clothing,
sure.
whatever, furniture. And they're in an old Catholic school, and they have all these different rooms. And the rooms, one room is jackets, one room is chairs, another room is something else. And they have one is books, and the other one is toys. And I looked in the toy room, and it's all this plastic stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
like Fisher-Price stuff.
Right.
But stuff that you know is not going to last. And there was a sadness to that.
Right.
Because it's emblematic of our disposable society.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live in a life with things that are disposable, ultimately it affects your psyche to the extent that relationships and people become disposable.
Right.
And that's wrong.
Right.
So things are very important. And teaching kids, hey, take care of this. You'll have it forever. And I bought my wife a number of years ago the Patty Play Pal doll that she had as a child.
Wow.
And like your mother, we got a doll from my sister that she had that was all broken, and we had it repaired and got it back to her.
Right.
And I called my cousin this year, my cousin Mike, who always, he ended up being in the stock market. He always wanted to be a cowboy, and he loves Roy Rogers. And I said, you know, Mike, we used to play with, we had a play set, the Roy Rogers Double R Bar Ranch, with the ranch house and the corral and the gate and the cowboys and the, you know, everything. And I said, they have them on eBay.
Wow.
Go buy one. Go get one and put it on the floor and sit down and play with it. And he said, you know, I think I will. So I hope he did.
So, no, I think you're right. I think these toys bring back a lot of memories. And as I said, I wish I could buy them. I know in my case, they're all gone because of the fact that they're, you know, they're in Cuba, and I'm sure they got all thrown away. But, you know, Frank, I wanted to wrap it up today that by saying that there's one person who's having a heck of a Christmas. And a heck of a 2021, and this young man Nicholas Sandman from Covington High
yes.
School, and he just settled with NBC for an estimated $250 million after he settled with CNN for a like amount. And I'm just sitting there saying, this kid is like 17 years old, and he I mean, pretty soon he's going to be owning these networks with all the money he's winning in these out-of-court settlements. And obviously NBC is settling out of court. The last thing they want to do is go to a jury, and the
right.
same with the others. But it just, you know, if somebody's having a happy Christmas, it's this young man and his family, of course. He's not even 18 years old. But in a
I
way,
I can only
it's kind
say
of nice.
I hope the money doesn't hurt him. Yes.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's exactly right. I hope he's, you know, he manages it well. But I was just thinking to myself that it is fair that he's winning these settlements and he's having a happy Christmas. I mean, it's like I can just imagine, you know, when he gets together with his friends, you know, somebody says, well, what did you get for Christmas? Well, I got, you know, a new dress or a new pair of pants or whatever. And then he said, what did you get, Nicholas? Well, I just got $250 million from NBC. So,
yeah, right.
I'm just saying, man.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, that's a happy Christmas. Frank, as always, thank you so much for your time. It's always a great honor to have you join us. And Merry Christmas to you and to your family and to your Christmas train that I'm sure you love so much. And I'm hoping to give our grandson a train maybe next year. because
marvelous.
I know they mean a lot. And but again, thank you for the reading today. Thank you for being a part of this. And I guess we can start planning our Thanksgiving and Christmas show for next year, Frank.
Oh, we will. And thank you so much for making me a part of this, Silvio. It's a great honor. It's most appreciated. This was a great year because I got to meet you and your lovely
That's
wife.
Right.
And you met Peggy, my wife. And it means a lot. So to you and to the family and to all listeners, I just want to say God bless, Merry Christmas, and take nothing for granted. Savor every moment.
That's right. Well, you know something, Frank? This year when we got together, we ate at that Greek restaurant in Milwaukee.
Yes.
And I still have the business card because
oh,
I thought I was going to drop the owner a line saying I enjoyed your lunch. And I never did. But now that I spoke to you, I think I will do it because I meant to do it and I forgot to do it. But anyway,
never too late.
Never too late. Never too late. But thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy your Christmas. Enjoy everything. And I guess we'll see you next. We're going to do a show in January about politics in Wisconsin and the elections. We'll save that for the next time, Frank.
That sounds great. Take care, Silvio. Much love to all.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us today. As always, Merry Christmas to you. Well, that's our good friend, Frank Burke. And we've been doing this quite a few years. And it's a lot of fun. Every year gets better. Every year gets better. And I did have the opportunity to meet him this year, which, of course, makes it a lot even better. Well, thank you, Frank. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Merry Christmas, and we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.